into the deck, did actually slide past the two humans and the watching drone, and clunk into the rear wall of the bay. Scaffin Antiskor picked up a fist-sized piece from near Smar's feet. The sound of the explosion echoed clangingly back off the walls a few times, gradually fading. Smar felt her ears relax.
"Happy, Sir Calway?" she asked.
He blinked, then switched the gun off and turned to Smar.
"Seems to be working all right now," he shouted.
Smar nodded.
"Mm-hmm."
He motioned with his head.
"Let's go get a drink."
He took up the goblet and drank as he walked towards the travel tube port.
"A drink,"
Smar said, falling into step with the man and nodding at the glass he was drinking from.
"Why? What's that?"
"Nearly finished, that's what this is," he told her loudly.
He poured a last half glass from the metal jug into the goblet.
"Ice?"
the drone offered, holding up the dripping black lump.
"No thanks."
Something flickered in the travel tube, and a capsule was suddenly there, door rolling open.
"What's this trapdoor coverage, anyway?" he asked the machine.
"General systems vehicle internal explosion protection,"
the drone explained, letting the humans board the capsule first.
"Snaps anything significantly more powerful than a fart straight into hyperspace. Blast, radiation, the lot."
"Shit," he said, disgusted. "You mean you can let nukes off in these fuckers and they don't even notice?"
The drone wobbled.
"They notice. Probably nobody else does."
The man stood swaying in the capsule, watching the door roll back into place, shaking his head sorrily.
"You people just have no idea of fair play, do you?"
The last time he'd been on a GSV had been 10 years earlier, after he'd almost died on Falls.
"Sharadanine. Sharadanine."
He heard the voice, but wasn't sure the woman was really talking to him. It was a beautiful voice. He wanted to reply to it, but he couldn't work out how to. It was very dark.
"Sharadanine."
A very patient voice. Concerned, somehow, but a hopeful voice. A cheerful, even loving voice. He tried to remember his mother.
"Sharadanine,"
the voice said again, trying to get him to wake up. But he was awake. He tried moving his lips.
"Sharadanine, can you hear me?"
He moved his lips, exhaled at the same time, and thought he might have produced a noise. He tried to open his eyes. The darkness wavered.
"Sharadanine?"
There was a hand at his face, gently stroking his cheek.
"Shias," he thought for a second, then swept that memory away to where he kept all the others.
He managed. Just the start of a sound.
"Sharadanine,"
the voice said, close to his ear now.
"It's Dizziat here. Dizziat Smar. Remember me?"
"Diz,"
he succeeded in saying, after a couple of failures.
"Sharadanine?"
"Yeah,"
he heard himself breathe.
"Try to open your eyes, will you?"
"Try and,"
he said. Then light came, as though it had had nothing to do with him trying to open his eyes. Things took a while to gel, but eventually he saw a restful green ceiling, illuminated from the sides by a fan-shaped glow of concealed lighting, and Dizziat Smar's face looking down at him.
"Well done, Sharadanine."
She smiled at him.
"How are you feeling?"
He thought about this.
"Weird," he said.
He was thinking hard now, trying to remember how he'd got here. Was this some sort of hospital? How had he got here?
"Where is this?" he said.
Might as well try the direct approach. He tried shifting his hands, but without success. Smar glanced somewhere over his head as he did so.
"The GSV Congenital Optimist. You're all right. You're going to be all right."
"If I'm all right, why can't I move my hands off?" Shit!
Suddenly, he was tied to the wooden frame again. The girl was in front of him. He opened his eyes and saw her. Smar. A misty, uncertain light glowed all around. He wrenched at his bonds, but there was no sign of give, no hope. He felt the tug on his hair, then the thudding cut of the blade, and saw the girl in the red robe looking at him from somewhere over his debodied head. Everything revolved. He closed his eyes. The moment passed. He swallowed. He took a breath and opened his eyes again. At least these things seemed to be working. Smar looked down, relieved.
You just remembered?
Yeah. I just remembered.
You going to be okay?
She sounded serious, but still reassuring.
I'll be all right, he said. Then, it's just a scratch.
She laughed, looked away for a bit, and when she looked to him again, she was biting her lip.
Hey, he said. Narrow one this time, huh?
He smiled.
Smar nodded. You could say that. Another few seconds and you'd have suffered brain damage. Another few minutes and you'd have been dead. If only you'd had a homing implant, we could have picked you up days...
Oh, now, Smar, he said gently. You know I can't be bothered with all that stuff.
Yeah, I know, she said. Well, whatever. You're going to have to stay like this for a while.
Smar smoothed hair from his forehead.
It'll take about 200 days or so to grow a new body. They want me to ask you, do you want to sleep through the whole thing, or do you want to stay awake as normal? Or anything in between? It's up to you. It makes no difference to the process.
He thought about this.
I suppose I get to do lots of improving things, like listen to music and watch films or whatever, and read.
If you want, Smar shrugged. You can go the whole hog and spool fantasy head tapes if you want.
Drink?
Drink?
Yeah. Can I get drunk?
I don't know, Smar said,
looking above and to one side. A voice muttered something.
Who's that? He asked.
Stade Paris. A young man nodded, coming into view upside down. Medic. Hello there, Mr. Zakalway. I'll be looking after you, however you decide to spend the time.
Do you dream when you're under, if you do it that way? He asked the medic.
Depends how deep you want to go. We can send you so far down you think no more than a second's passed during those 200 days, or you can lucid dream every second of them, whatever you want.
What do most people do?
Switch right off. Wake up with a new body after no appreciable time.
Thought so. Can I get drunk while I'm hooked up to whatever the hell it is I'm hooked up to?
Stade Paris grinned.
I'm sure we could arrange it if you want. We could give you drug glands.
Ideal opportunity, just no thanks.
He closed his eyes briefly and tried to shake his head.
Occasional inebriety will be quite sufficient.
Stade Paris nodded.
Well, I think we can rig you for that.
Great.
Smar?
He looked at her. She raised her eyebrows.
I'll stay awake, he told her.
Smar smiled slowly.
I had a feeling you might.
Are you sticking around?
Could do, the woman said. Would you like me to?
I'd appreciate it.
And I'd like to.
She nodded thoughtfully.
Okay, I'll watch you put on weight.
Thanks. And thanks for not bringing that goddamn drone. I can imagine the jokes.
Yes, Smar said hesitantly.
So that he said,
Smar?
What is it?
Well,
the woman looked uncomfortable.
Tell me.
Scaffan Amtiscor, she said awkwardly. It sent you a present.
She fished a small package from her pocket, flourished it, embarrassed.
I don't know what it is, but...
Well, I can't open it.
Come on, Smar.
Smar opened the package. She looked at the contents. Stade Paris leant over and then turned quickly away, holding one hand at his mouth, coughing. Smar pursed her lips.
I may ask for a new escort drone.
He closed his eyes.
What is it?
It's a hat.
He laughed at that. Smar did too, eventually, though she threw things at the drone later. Stade Paris accepted the hat as an onward gift. It was only later, in the dim red of the hospital section light, while Smar danced slowly with some new conquest, and Stade Paris was dining out with friends and telling them the story of the hat, and life went on throughout the rest of the great ship, that he remembered how, a few years earlier and very far away, Shears Engin had traced the wounds on his body. Cool, slim fingers on the puckered, new-looking flesh, the smell of her skin, and the tingling sweep of her hair. And in 200 days, he would have a new body and...
And this? I'm sorry. Still fresh, that one.
The wound over his heart would be gone forever, and the heart beneath his chest would not be the same one. And he realized he had lost her. Not Shias Engin, whom he'd loved, or thought he had and certainly lost. But her. The other one. The real one. The one who'd lived within him through a century of icy sleep. He had thought he would not lose her until the day he died. Now he knew differently, and felt broken by the knowledge and the loss. He whispered her name to the quiet red night. Overhead, the ever-watchful medical monitoring unit saw some fluid seep from the bodiless human's tear ducts and wondered dumbly at it.
How old is old Soldrin now?
80 relative, the drone said.
You think he'll want to come out of retirement just because I ask him to?
He looked sceptical.
You're all we could think of, Smar told him.
Can't you just let the old guy grow old in peace?
There's a little more at stake than the happy retirement of one aging politico, Zagalway.
What? The universe? Life as we know it?
Yes. Tens, maybe hundreds of millions of times over.
Very philosophical.
And you didn't let the ethnoc Kerion grow old in peace, did you?
Damn right, he said, and wandered a little further into the armory. That old pisshead deserved to die a million times.
The converted mini-bay engineering space housed a dazzling array of culture and other weaponry. Zakalway, Smar thought, was like a kid in a toy store. He was selecting gear and loading it onto a pallet, which Scaffin Antiscor was guiding after the man down the aisles of racks and drawers and shelves, all stuffed and packed with projectile weapons, line guns, laser rifles, plasma projectors, multitudinous grenades, effectors, plane charges, passive and reactive armor, sensory and guard devices, full combat suits, missile packs, and at least a dozen other distinctly different types of device Smar didn't recognize.
You'll never be able to carry this lot, Zakalway.
This is just the short list, he told her.
He took a stocky, boxy-looking gun with no appreciable barrel from a shelf. He held it out to the drone.
What's this?
Cruz, assault rifle, Scaffin Antiscor said. 7 14-ton batteries, 7-element single shot to 44.8 kilorounds a second. Minimum firing time, 8.75 seconds. Maximum single burst, 7 times 250 kilograms. Frequency from mid-visible to high X-ray.
He hefted it.
Not very well balanced.
That's its stowed configuration. Slide the whole top back.
He pretended to aim the readied gun.
Now, what's to stop you putting your supporting hand over here, where the beams are going?
Common sense,
suggested the drone.
I'll stick with my obsolete plasma rifle.
He put the gun back. Anyway, Smar, you should be pleased old men do want to come out of retirement for you.
Damn it, I should be devoting myself to gardening or something, not storming off to the galactic backwards doing your dirty work.
Oh, yeah, Smar said, and a big struggle I had too, convincing you to quit your gardening and come back to us. Shit, Zakalway, your bags were packed.
I must have telepathically already have realized the urgency of the situation.
He heaved a massive black gun from a rack, swung it with both hands, grunting with the effort.
Holy shit! Do you fire this mother or just use it as a battering ram?
Ydiran hand cannon, Scaffin Antiscor sighed. Don't wave it around like that. It's very old and quite rare.
No fucking wonder.
He struggled to lift the gun back into its rack, then continued down the aisle. Come to think of it, Smar, I'm so old, my whole life ought to be on triple time or something. I'm probably grossly undercharging you for this whole sorry escapade.
Well, if you're going to look at it that way, we should be charging you for... patent infringement? Giving those old guys their youth back using our technology.
Don't knock it. You don't know what it's like getting that old that early.
Yeah, but it applies to everybody. You were giving it only to the most evil power mad bastards on the planet.
They were top-down societies, what do you expect? Anyway, if I'd given it to everybody, think of the population explosion.
Zakalwe, I thought about that when I was about 15. They teach you that sort of stuff in early school in the culture. It was all thought through long ago. It's part of our history, part of our upbringing. That's why what you did would look insane to a school kid. You are like a school kid to us. You don't even want to get old. Nothing more immature than that.
Ooh, he said, stopping suddenly and taking something from an open shelf. What's this?
Beyond your ken, Scaffin Amtiscor said.
What a beauty.
He gripped the stunningly complicated weapon and twirled it.
What is this? He breathed.
Micro-armament system, rifle, the drone narrated. It's... Oh, look, Zakalwe. It has 10 separate weapon systems, not including the semi-sentient guard facility, the reactive shield components, the IFF set quick reaction swing packs, or the AG unit. And before you ask, the controls are all on the wrong side because that's the left-hand bias version, and the balance, like the weight and the independently variable inertia, are fully adjustable. It also takes about half a year's training just to learn how to use it safely, let alone competently, so you can't have one.
I don't want one, he said, stroking the weapon. But what a device!
He put it back with the rest. He glanced at Smar.
Dizzy, I know the way you people think. I respect it, I guess. But your life isn't my life. I live in unsafe ways in dangerous places, always have done, always will do. I'll die soon enough anyway, so why should I suffer the additional burden of getting old, even slowly?
Don't try and hide behind necessities, Zakalwe. You could have changed your life. You don't have to live the way you do. You could have joined the culture, become one of us. At least live the way we do, but
Smar, he exclaimed, turning to her. That's for you. It isn't for me. You think I'm wrong to have my age stabilized. Even the chance of immortality is wrong to you. Okay, I can see that. In your society, the way you live your lives, of course it is. You have your 350, 400 years, and know you'll get right to the end of them. Die with your boots off. For me, that won't work. I don't have that certainty. I enjoy the perspective from the edge, Smar. I like to feel that updraft on my face. So sooner or later I'll die, violently, probably. Maybe even foolishly, because that's often the way of it. You avoid nukes and determined assassins, and then choke on a fishbone. But who cares? So, your stasis is your society, and mine is my age. But we are both assured of death.
Smar looked at the floor, hands clasped behind her back. All right, she said. But don't forget who gave you that perspective from the edge. He smiled sadly.
Yes, you saved me.
But you've also lied to me, sent me on damn-fool missions where I was on the opposite side from the one I thought I was on, had me fight for incompetent aristos I'd gladly have strangled in wars where I didn't know you were backing both sides, filled my balls full of alien seed I was supposed to inject into some poor damn female, nearly got me killed, very nearly got me killed a dozen times or more.
You've never forgiven me for that hat, have you? Scaffin Amtiscor said with fake bitterness.
Oh, Sharadanin, Smar said. Don't pretend it hasn't been fun, too.
Smar, believe me, it has not all been fun.
He leant against a cabinet full of ancient projectile weapons. And worse than all that, he insisted, is when you turn the goddamn maps upside down.
What? Smar said, puzzled. Turning the maps upside down, he repeated. Have you any idea how annoying and inconvenient it is when you get to a place and find that they map the place the other way up compared to the maps you've got? Because of something stupid like some people think a magnetic needle is pointing up to heaven when other people think it's just heavier and pointing down, or because it's done according to the galactic plane or something. I mean, this might sound trivial, but it's very upsetting.
Zakalwe, I had no idea. Let me offer you my apologies and those of the entire special circumstances section. No, all of contact. No, the entire culture. No, all intelligent species.
Smile, you remorseless bitch. I'm trying to be serious.
No, I don't think you are.
Maps, but it's true. They turn them the wrong way up.
Then there must,
Dizziet Smar said, be a reason for it.
What? He demanded.
Psychology,
Smar and the drone said at the same time.
Two suits,
Smar said later, when he was making his final equipment selection.
They were still in the armory mini-bay, but Scaffin Antiscor had gone off to do something more interesting than watch a kid shop for toys.
He heard the accusatory tone in Smar's voice and looked up.
Yes, two suits. So what?
Those can be used to imprison somebody, Sir Calway. I know that. They're not just for protection.
Smar, if I'm lifting this guy out of a hostile environment, with no immediate help from you guys because you have to stand off and be seen to be pure, fake though that might be, I have to have the tools to do the job. Serious FYT suits are numbered among those tools.
One,
Smar said.
Smar, don't you trust me?
One,
Smar repeated.
God damn it. All right.
He dragged the suit away from the pile of equipment.
Sheratanine,
Smar said, suddenly conciliatory.
Remember, we need Beishai's commitment, not just his presence. That's why we couldn't impersonate him. That's why we couldn't tamper with his mind.
Smar, you're sending me to tamper with his mind.
All right, Smar said, suddenly nervous looking.
She clapped her hands once, softly, looked a little embarrassed.
By the way, Sheratanine, what exactly are your plans? I know better than to ask for a mission profile or anything formal, but how do you mean to get to Beishai?
He sighed. I'm going to make him want to come to me.
How?
Just one word.
A word?
A name.
What? Yours?
No. Mine was supposed to be kept a secret when I was advisor to Beishai, but it must have leaked out by now. Too dangerous. I'll use another name.
Aha.
Smar looked expectantly at him, but he went back to choosing between the various bits of equipment he'd picked out. Beishai's in this university, right? He said, not turning to look at Smar.
Yes, in the archives, almost permanently. But there are a lot of archives, and he moves around a lot, and there are always guards.
Okay, he told her. If you want to do something useful, try finding something that the university might want. Smar shrugged.
It's a capitalist society. How about money?
I'll be doing that myself.
He paused, looked suspicious. I will be allowed plenty of discretion in that area, won't I?
Unlimited expenses, Smar nodded.
He smiled.
Wonderful, he paused. What source? A ton of platinum? Sack of diamonds? My own bank?
Well, more or less your own bank, yes, Smar said. We've been building up something called the Vanguard Foundation since the last war. Commercial empire, comparatively ethical, expanding quietly. That's where your unlimited expenses will come from.
Well, with my unlimited expenses, I'll probably try offering this university lots of money.
But it would be better if there was some actual thing we could tempt them with.
All right, she said, nodding. Then her brow wrinkled. She indicated the combat suit.
What did you call that thing?
He looked puzzled, then said,
Oh, it's an FYT suit.
Yes, a serious FYT suit, that's what you said. But I thought I knew all the nomenclature. I've never heard that acronym before. What does it stand for?
It stands for a serious fuck you too suit.
He grinned. Smar made a clicking noise with her tongue.
Should have known better than to ask, shouldn't I?
2 days later, they stood in the hangar of the Xenophobe. The very fast picket had left the GSV a day earlier, slung at the Verenhertz cluster. It had accelerated hard, and now it was braking hard. He was packing the gear he would need into a capsule that would take him down to the surface of the planet where Tsoldrin Beishai was. The initial stage of his in-system journey would be on a fast three-person module. It would loiter in the atmosphere of a nearby gas giant planet. The Xenophobe itself would wait in interstellar space, ready to provide support if needed.
Are you positive you don't want Scaffin Antiscor to come with you?
Absolutely positive. Keep that airborne asshole to yourself.
Some other drone?
No.
A knife missile?
Dizziet, no. I don't want Scaffin Antiscor or anything else that thinks it can think for itself.
Hey, Just refer to me as though I'm not here, Scaffin Antiscor said.
Wishful thinking, drone.
Better than none at all, so above par for you, the machine said.
He looked at the drone.
Are you sure they didn't issue a factory recall on your batch number?
Myself, said the drone sniffily. I have never been able to see what virtue there could be in something that was 80% water. Anyway, Smar said, you know all the relevant stuff, yes?
Yes, he said tiredly.
The man's tanned, smoothly muscled body rippled as he bent, securing the plasma rifle in the capsule. He wore a pair of briefs. Smar, hair still tousled from bed, for this was early morning by ship time, wore a jellaba.
You know the people to contact, she fretted. And who's in charge and on what side?
And what to do if my credit facilities are suddenly withdrawn? Yes, everything.
If, when you get him out, you head for
the enchanting sunny system of Impren, he said tiredly in a sing-song voice, where there are lots of friendly natives in a variety of ecologically sound space habitats, which are neutral.
Sir Calway, Smar said suddenly, taking his face in both hands and kissing him. I hope this all works out.
Me too, funnily enough, he said.
He kissed Smar back. She pulled away eventually. He shook his head, running his gaze down and up the woman's body, grinning.
Ah, one day, Dizyet.
She shook her head and smiled insincerely.
Not unless I'm unconscious or dead, Sheradanine.
Oh, I can still hope then.
Smar slapped his backside. On your way, Sir Calway. He stepped into the armoured combat suit. It closed around him. He flipped the helmet back. He looked suddenly serious.
You just make sure you know where...
We know where she is, Smar said quickly.
He looked at the floor of the hangar for a moment, then smiled back into Smar's eyes.
Good. He clapped his gloves together. Great. I'll be off. See you later, with any luck.
He stepped into the capsule.
Take care, Sheradanine, Smar said.
Yes, look after your disgusting cloven butt, Scaffin Amtiscor said.
Depend on it, he said, and blew both of them a kiss.
From General Systems vehicle, to very fast picket, to small module, to the lobbed capsule, to the suit that stood in the cold desert dust, with a man encased inside it. He looked out through the open faceplate and wiped a little sweat from his brow. It was dusk over the plateau. A few meters away, by the light of two moons and a fading sun, he could see the rimrock, frost-whitened. Beyond was the great gash in the desert, which provided the setting for the ancient, half-empty city where Tsoldrin Beishai now lived. Clouds drifted and the dust collected.
Well,
he sighed to no one in particular, and looked up into yet another alien sky.
Here we are again.
Numeral 8. The man stood on a tiny spur of clay and watched the roots of the huge tree as they were uncovered and washed bare by a gurgling wash of dun-coloured water. Rain swarmed through the air. The broad brown swell of rushing water tearing at the roots of the tree leapt with thrashing spray. The rain alone had brought visibility down to a couple of 100 meters and had long since soaked the man in the uniform to the skin. The uniform was meant to be grey, but the rain and the mud had turned it dark brown. It had been a fine, well-fitting uniform, but the rain and the mud had reduced it to a flopping rag. The tree tipped and fell, crashing back into the brown torrent and spraying mud over the man, who stepped back and lifted his face to the dull grey sky to let the incessant rain wash the mud from his skin. The great tree blocked the thundering stream of brown slurry and forced some of it over the clay spur, forcing the man further back, along a crude stone wall, to a high lintel of ancient concrete, which stretched, cracked and uneven, up to a small ugly cottage squatting near the crown of the concrete hill. He stayed, watching the long brown bruise of the swollen river as it flowed over and ate into the little isthmus of clay. Then the spur collapsed, the tree lost its anchorage on that side of the river and was turned round and turned over and transported bodily on the back of the tumbling waters, heading into the sodden valley and the low hills beyond. The man looked at the crumbling bank on the other side of the flood, where the great tree's roots protruded from the earth like ripped cables. Then he turned and walked heavily up towards the little cottage. He walked round it. The vast, square concrete plinth, nearly a half kilometre to a side, was still surrounded by water. Brown waves washed its edges on every side. The towering hulks of ancient metal structures, long since fallen into disrepair, loomed through the haze of rain, squatting on the pitted and cracked surface of the concrete like forgotten pieces in some enormous game. The cottage, already made ridiculous by the expanse of concrete around it, looked somehow even more grotesque than the abandoned machines, just because of their proximity. The man looked all about as he walked round the building, but saw nothing that he wanted to see. He went into the cottage. The assassin flinched as he threw open the door. The chair she was tied to, a small wooden thing, was balanced precariously against a thick set of drawers, and when she jerked, its legs rasped on the stone floor and sent chair and girl sliding to the ground with a whack. She hit her head on the flagstones and cried out. He sighed. He walked over, boots squelching with each step, and dragged the chair upright, kicking a piece of broken mirror away as he did so. The woman was hanging slackly, but he knew she was faking. He manoeuvred the chair into the centre of the small room. He watched the woman carefully as he did this, and kept out of the way of her head. Earlier, when he'd been tying her up, she'd butted him in the face, very nearly breaking his nose. He looked at her bonds. The rope that bound her hands behind the back of the chair was frayed. She had been trying to cut through the bindings using the broken hand mirror from the top of the set of drawers. He left her hanging inertly in the middle of the room, where he could see her, then went over to the small bed cut into one thick wall of the cottage and fell heavily into it. It was dirty, but he was exhausted and too wet to care. He listened to the rain hammering on the roof, and listened to the wind whining through the door and the shuttered windows, and listened to the steady plopping of drops coming through the leaking roof and dropping onto the flagstones. He listened for the noise of helicopters, but there were no helicopters. He had no radio, and he wasn't sure they knew where to look anyway. They would be searching as well as the weather allowed, but they'd be looking for his staff car, and it was gone, washed away by the brown avalanche of river. Probably it would take days. He closed his eyes and started to fall asleep almost immediately. But it was as though the consciousness of defeat would not let him escape, and found him even there, filling his nearly sleeping mind with images of inundation and defeat, and harried him out of his rest, back into the continuing pain and dejection of wakefulness. He rubbed his eyes, but the scummy water on his hands ground grains of sand and earth into his eyes. He cleaned one finger as best he could on the filthy rags on the bed, and rubbed some spit into his eyes, because he thought if he allowed himself to cry, he might not be able to stop. He looked at the woman. She was pretending to come round. He wished he had the strength and the inclination to go over and hit her. But he was too tired, and too conscious that he would be taking out on her the defeat of an entire army. Belting any one individual, let alone a helpless, cross-eyed woman, would be so pathetically petty a way of trying to find recompense for a downfall of that magnitude that even if he did live, he would be ashamed forever that he had done such a thing. She moaned dramatically. A thin strand of snot detached itself from her nose and fell onto the heavy coat she wore. He looked away, disgusted. He heard her sniff loudly. When he looked back, her eyes were open, and she was staring malevolently at him. She was only slightly cross-eyed, but the imperfection annoyed him more than it should have. Given a bath and a decent set of clothes, he thought, the woman might almost have looked pretty. But right now she was buried inside a greasy green greatcoat, smudged all over with mud, and her dirty face was almost completely hidden, partially by the collar of the heavy coat, and partially by her long, filthy hair, which was attached to the green greatcoat in various places by glistening blobs of mud. She moved oddly in the chair, as though scratching her back against the chair. He could not decide whether she was testing the ropes that bound her, or was just troubled by fleas. He doubted she had been sent to kill him. Almost certainly she was what she was dressed as, an auxiliary. Probably she'd been left behind in a retreat and had wandered about too frightened or proud or stupid to surrender, until she had seen the staff car in difficulties in the storm-washed hollow. Her attempt at killing him had been brave, but laughable. By sheer luck, she'd killed his driver with one shot. A second had struck him a glancing blow on the side of the head, making him groggy, while she threw the empty gun away and leapt into the car with her knife. The driverless car had slid down a greasy grass slope into the brown torrent of the river. Such a stupid act. Sometimes heroics revolted him. They seemed like an insult to the soldier who weighed the risks of the situation and made calm, cunning decisions based on experience and imagination. The sort of unshowy soldiering that didn't win medals, but wars. Still dazed from the bullet graze, he had fallen into the car's rear footwell as it pitched and yawed, caught in the swollen force of the river. The woman had nearly buried him in the voluminous thick coat. Stuck like that, head still ringing from the shot that had grazed his skull, he'd been unable to get a good swing at her. For those absurd, confined, frustrating minutes, the struggle with the girl had seemed like a microcosm of the plane-wide muddle his army was now embroiled in. He had the strength to knock her out cold, but the cramped battleground and the hiding weight of her enveloping coat had muffled him and imprisoned him until it was too late. The car had hit the concrete island and tipped right over, throwing them both out onto the corroded grey surface. The woman had given a little scream. She'd raised the knife that had been caught in the folds of the green greatcoat all that time, but he had finally got his clear punch and connected satisfyingly with her chin. She'd thumped back to the concrete. He'd turned round to see the car scraping off the slipway, torn away by the surging brown tide. Still on its side, it had sunk almost immediately. He'd turned back and felt tempted to kick the unconscious woman. He'd kicked the knife instead, sending it whirling away into the river, following the drowned staff car.
"You won't win," the woman said, spitting. "You can't win against us."
She shook the little chair angrily.
"What?" he said, shaken from his reverie.
"We'll win,"
she said, giving a furious shake that rattled the chair's legs on the stone floor.
"Why did I tie the silly fool to a chair, of all things?" he thought. "You could well be right," he told her tiredly. "Things are looking damp at the moment. Make you feel any better?"
"You're going to die," the woman said, staring.
"Nothing more certain than that," he agreed, gazing at the leaking roof above the rag bed.
"We are invincible. We will never give up."
"Well, you've proved fairly vincible before," he sighed, remembering the history of this place.
"We were betrayed," the woman shouted. "Our armies never were defeated. We were
stabbed in the back, I know."
"Yes, but our spirit will never die. We..."
"Oh, shut up," he said,
swinging his legs off the narrow bed and facing the woman.
"I've heard that shit before. We was robbed. The folks back home let us down. The media were against us. Shit."
He ran a hand through his wet hair. Only the very young or the very stupid think wars are waged just by the military. As soon as news travels faster than a dispatch rider or a bird's leg, the whole nation, whatever, is fighting.
That's your spirit. Your will, not the grunt on the ground. If you lose, you lose. Don't whine about it. You'd have lost this time too if it hadn't been for this fucking rain.
He held up a hand as the woman drew breath.
"And no, I don't believe God is on your side."
"Heretic."
"Thank you."
"I hope your children die slowly."
He said. "I'm not sure I qualify, but if I do, it would be a long spit."
He collapsed back on the bed, then looked aghast and levered himself back up again.
"Shit! They really must get to you, people young. That's a terrible thing for anybody to say, let alone a woman."
"Our women are more manly than your men,"
the woman sneered. "And still you breed. Choice must be limited, I suppose."
"May your children suffer and die horribly,"
the woman shrieked.
"Well, if that's really the way you feel," he sighed, lying back again, "then there's nothing worse I can wish on you than to be exactly the fuckhead you so obviously are."
"Barbarian, infidel!"
"You'll run out of expletives soon. I'd advise saving some for later. Not that keeping forces in reserve has ever been precisely you guys' strong point, has it?"
"We will crush you."
"Hey, I'm crushed. I'm crushed."
He waved one hand languidly.
"Now back off."
The woman howled and shook the small chair. Maybe, he thought, I ought to be thankful for the chance to be away from the responsibilities of command. The minute-to-minute changes in conditions that the fools couldn't deal with themselves and that bogged you down as surely as the mud. The continual flood of reports of units immobilised, washed away, deserting, cut off, retreating from vital positions, yelling for help, for relief, for reinforcements, more trucks, more tanks, more rafts, more food, more radios. Past a certain point, there was nothing he could do. He could only acknowledge, reply, turn down, delay, order to make a stand. Nothing. Nothing. The reports kept on coming in, building up like a one-colour paper mosaic of a million pieces. The picture of an army, bit by bit, disintegrating, softened by the rain just like a sheet of paper, made soggy and terrible, and gradually coming apart. That was what he was escaping by being marooned here. Yet, he was not secretly thankful. He was not actually glad. He was furious and angry at being away, at leaving it all in the hands of others, of being away from the centre, from knowing what was happening. He fretted like a mother for a young son just marched off to war, driven to tears or pointless screams for the powerlessness of it, the heedless, unstoppable momentum. It struck him then that the whole process didn't really require any enemy forces at all. The battle was him and the army under his command against the elements. A third party was superfluous. First the rains, then their unheard-of severity, then the landslide that had cut them off from the rest of the command convoy, then this bedraggled idiot of a would-be assassin. He swung back upright again, held his head in his hands. Had he tried to do too much? He had had 10 hours' sleep in the last week. Had that clouded his mind, impaired his judgment? Or had he slept too much? Might that little extra bit of wakefulness have made all the difference? I hope you die, the woman's voice squawked. He looked at her frowning, wondering why she had interrupted his thoughts, wishing she'd shut up. Maybe he should gag her. You're retreating, he pointed out. A minute ago you were telling me I would die. He slumped back on the bed. Bastard, she screamed. He looked at her, suddenly thinking that he was as much a prisoner where he lay as she was where she sat. Snot gathered under her nose again. He looked away. He heard her snort back, then spit. He would have smiled if he'd had the strength. She showed contempt with the spit. What was her one dribble compared to the deluge that was drowning a fighting machine he had worked 2 years to bring together and train? And why? Why had he tied her to a chair, of all things? Did he try to make chance and fate redundant by scheming against himself? A chair. A girl tied to the chair. About the same age, maybe a little older. But the same slim figure, with a lying greatcoat that tried to pretend she was bigger but failed. About the same age. About the same shape. He shook his head, forcing his thoughts away from that battle, that failure. She saw him look at her and shake his head. Don't you laugh at me! She screamed, shaking backwards and forwards in the chair, furious at his scorn. Shut up! Shut up! He said wearily. He knew it wasn't convincing, but he could not sound any more authoritative. She shut up, remarkably. The rains and her. Sometimes he wished he did believe in fate. Maybe it did sometimes help to believe in gods. Sometimes, like now, when things fell against him and every turn he took brought him up against another vicious twist of the knife, another hammering on the bruises he'd already collected. It would be comforting to think that it was all designed, all preordained, all already written, and you just turned the pages of some great and inviolable book. Maybe you never did get a chance to write your own story. And so his own name, even that attempt at terms mocked him. He didn't know what to think. Was there as petty and suffocating a destiny as some people seemed to think? He didn't want to be here. He wanted to be back where the busy to and fro of report and command stifled all other traffic in the mind. You're losing. You've lost this battle, haven't you? He considered saying nothing. But on reflection, she would take this as a sign he was weak and so continue.
What a penetrating insight, he sighed.
You remind me of some of the people who planned this war. Cross-eyed, stupid and static.
I'm not cross-eyed!
She screamed, and instantly started crying. Her head, forced down by the weight of huge sobs that shook her body and waved the folds of the coat, making the chair creak. Her dirty long hair hid her face, falling from her head over the wide lapels of the greatcoat. Her arms were almost level with the ground, so far forward had she slumped in her crying. He wanted the strength to go over and cuddle her, or bash her brains out. Anything to stop her making that unnecessary noise.
All right. All right, you haven't got cross eyes. I'm sorry.
He lay back with one arm thrown across his eyes, hoping he sounded convincing. But sure, he sounded as insincere as he was.
I don't want your sympathy.
Sorry again. I retract the retraction.
Well, I haven't. It's just a slight defect, and it didn't stop the army bot from taking me.
They were also, he recalled, taking children and pensioners, but he didn't say that to the woman. She was trying to wipe her face on the lapels of the greatcoat. She sniffed heavily, and when she brought her head back and her hair swung away, he saw there was a large dewdrop on the tip of her nose. He got up without thinking, the tiredness shrieking in indignation, and tore a portion of the thin curtain over the bed alcove off as he went over to her. She saw him coming with the ragged scrap and screamed with all her might. She emptied her lungs with the effort of announcing to the rainy world outside that she was about to be murdered. She was rocking the chair, and he had to jump at it and land with one boot on one of the cross members between the legs to stop it from tipping over. He put the rag over her face. She stopped struggling. She went limp, not fighting or squirming, but knowing it was utterly pointless to go on doing anything.
Good, he said, relieved. Now blow.
She blew. He withdrew the rag, folded it over, put it back over her face, and told her to blow again. She blew again. He folded it over again and wiped her nose hard. She squealed. It was sore. He sighed again and threw the rag away. He didn't lie down again because it only made him sleepy and thoughtful. And he didn't want to sleep because he felt he might never wake up. And he didn't want to think because it wasn't getting him anywhere. He turned away and stood at the door, which was as closed anywhere as it could be, and still half open. Rain spattered in. He thought of the others, the other commanders.
Damn!
The only other one he trusted was Rogtum Bar, and he was too junior to take charge. He hated being put into positions like this, coming in on an already established command structure, usually corrupt, usually nepotistic, and having to take so much on himself that any absence, any hesitation, even any rest, gave the clueless frothheads around him a chance to fuck things up even further. But then, he told himself, what general was ever totally happy with the command he took over? Anyway, he hadn't left them enough. A few crazy plans that would almost certainly never come off. His attempts to use the weapons that were not obvious. Too much of it was still inside his own head. That one private place where he knew even the culture did not look, though through their own warped fastidiousness, not through inability. He forgot all about the woman. It was as if she didn't exist when he wasn't looking at her, and her voice and her attempt to cut herself free were the results of some absurd, supernatural manifestation. He opened the cottage door wide. You could see anything in the rain. The individual drops became streaks with the slowness of the eye. They merged and re-emerged as ciphers for the shapes you carried inside you. They lasted less than a heartbeat in your sight, and they went on forever. He saw a chair and a ship that was not a ship. He saw a man with two shadows, and he saw that which cannot be seen. A concept. The adaptive, self-seeking urge to survive. To bend everything that can be reached to that end. And to remove, and to add, and to smash, and to create, so that one particular collection of cells can go on, can move onwards and decide, and keeping moving, and keeping deciding, knowing that, if nothing else, at least it lives. And it had two shadows.
It was two things. It was the need, and it was the method. The need was obvious, to defeat what opposed its life. The method was that taking and bending of materials and people to one purpose, the outlook that everything could be used in the fight, that nothing could be excluded, that everything was a weapon, and the ability to handle those weapons, to find them and choose which one to aim and fire, that talent, that ability, that use of weapons. A chair and a ship that was not a ship. A man with two shadows and...
What are you going to do with me?
The woman's voice was quivering. He looked round at her.
I don't know. What do you think?
She looked at him with her eyes widening, horrified. She seemed to be gathering her breath for another scream. He didn't understand it. He'd asked her a perfectly normal, pertinent question, and she acted as if he'd said he was going to kill her.
Please don't. Oh, please don't. Oh, please, please don't.
She sobbed again dryly. Then her back seemed to break, and her imploring face bowed almost to her knees as she drooped again. Do what? He was mystified. She didn't appear to hear him. She just hung there, her slack body jerked by her sobs. It was at moments like this he stopped understanding people. He just had no comprehension of what was going on in their minds. They were denied, unfathomable. He shook his head and started walking round the room. It was smelly and damp, and it carried this atmosphere as though this was no innovation. This had always been a hole. Probably some illiterate had lived here, custodian of the derelict machines from another, more fabulous age, long shattered by the conspicuous love of war these people exhibited. A mean life in an ugly place. When would they come? Would they find him? Would they think he was dead? Had they heard his message on the radio after the landslide had cut them off from the rest of the command convoy? Had he worked the damn thing right? Maybe he hadn't. Maybe he would be left behind. They might think a search was useless. He hardly cared. It would be no additional pain to be captured. He'd drowned in that already in his mind. He could almost welcome it. If he set his mind to it, he knew he could. All he needed was the strength to be bothered.
If you're going to kill me, please, will you do it quickly?
He was getting annoyed at these constant interruptions. Well, I wasn't going to kill you, but keep on whining like this, and I may change my mind.
I hate you.
It seemed to be all she could think of.
And I hate you too.
She started crying again loudly. He looked out into the rain again and saw the Stabberrind. Defeat. Defeat, the rain whispered. Tanks foundering in the mud, the men giving up under the torrential rain, everything coming to bits. And a stupid woman and a runny nose. He could laugh at it, at the sharing of time and place between the grand and the petty, the magnificently vast and the shoddily absurd, like horrified nobility having to share a carriage with drunken, dirty peasants being sick over them and copulating under them, the finery and fleas. Laugh. That was the only answer, the only reply that couldn't be bettered or itself laughed down, the lowest of the low of common denominators. Do you know who I am? He said, turning suddenly. The thought had just occurred to him that maybe she didn't realize who he was, and he wouldn't have been in the least surprised to find out that she had tried to kill him just because he was in a big car, and not because she had recognized the commander-in-chief of the entire army. He wouldn't be at all surprised to find that. He almost expected it. She looked up.
What?
Do you know who I am? Do you know my name or rank?
No,
she spat.
Should I?
No. No, he laughed and turned away.
He looked briefly out at the grey wall of rain, as though it was an old friend, then turned, went back to the bed, and fell onto it again. The government wouldn't like it either. Oh, the things he'd promised them, the riches, the lands, the gains of wealth, prestige and power. They'd have him shot if the culture didn't pull him out. They'd see him dead for this defeat. It would have been their victory, but it would be his defeat. Standard complaint. He tried to tell himself that, mostly, he'd won. He knew he had, but it was only the moments of defeat,
the instance of paralysis that made him really think and try to join up the weave of his life into a whole. That was when his thoughts returned to the battleship Stabberind and what it represented. That was when he thought about the chairmaker and the reverberating guilt behind that banal description. It was a better sort of defeat this time. It was more impersonal. He was the commander of the army. He was responsible to the government, and they could remove him. In the final reckoning, then, he was not responsible. They were. And there was nothing personal in the conflict. He'd never met the leaders of the enemy. They were strangers to him. Only their military habits and their patterns of favoured troop movements and types of build-up were familiar. The cleanness of that schism seemed to soften the rain of blows. A little. He envied people who could be born, be raised, mature with those around them, have friends, and then settle down in one place with one set of acquaintances, live ordinary and unspectacular, unrisky lives and grow old and be replaced, their children coming to see them, and die old and senile, content with all that had gone before. He could never have believed he would ever feel like this, that he would so ache to be like that, to have despairs just so deep, joys just so great, to never strain the fabric of life or fate, but to be minor, unimportant, uninfluential. It seemed utterly sweet, infinitely desirable, now and forever, because once in that situation, once you were there, would you ever feel the awful need to do as he had done and try for those heights? He doubted it. He turned back to look at the woman in the chair. But it was pointless. It was stupid. He thought about thoughtless things. If I were a seabird... But how could you be a seabird? If you were a seabird, your brain would be tiny and stupid, and you would love half-rotted fish guts and tweaking the eyes out of little grazing animals. You would know no poetry, and you could never appreciate flying as fully as the human on the ground, yearning to be you. If you wanted to be a seabird, you deserved to be one. Ah, the camp leader and the camp follower. You haven't quite got it right, though, sir. You're supposed to tie her in the bed. He jumped, spun round, hand going to the holster at his waist. Kiraev Sokrov Turogtambar kicked the door shut, and stood shaking rain from a large shiny cape in the doorway, smiling ironically, and looking annoyingly fresh and handsome, considering he'd had no sleep for days. Bah! He almost ran to him. They clapped their arms about each other and laughed. The very same. General Zakalway. Hello there. I wondered if you would like to join me in a stolen vehicle. I have an amph outside. What? He threw open the door again and looked out into the waters. There was a large and battered amphibious truck 50 meters away, near one of the towering machines. That's one of their trucks, he laughed. Rogtam Bar nodded unhappily. Yes, I'm afraid so. They seem to want it back, too. They do? He laughed again. Yes, by the way, I'm afraid the government has fallen, forced out of office. What? Because of this? That's the impression I got, I must say. I think they were so busy blaming you for losing their idiotic war that they didn't realise people connected them with it as well. Wide asleep, as usual. Rogtam Bar smiled. Oh, and that manic idea of yours, the commando squad placing the sink charges on the Maklin Reservoir? It worked. Send all that water into the dam and made the thing overflow. Didn't actually break, according to the intelligence reports, but it... overtopped? Is that the expression? Anyway... An awful lot of water went down the valley and swept away most of the Fifth Army's high command, not to mention quite a bit of the Fifth itself, judging from the bods and tents seen floating past our lines over the last few hours. And there we all were, thinking you were crazy for dragging that hydrologist around with the general staff for the past week. Rogtam Bar clapped his gloved hands. Whatever. Things must be serious. There's talk of peace, I'm afraid. He looked the general up and down. But you'll have to present a prettier picture than that, I suspect, if we're to start talking terms with our pals on the other side. You've been mud-wrestling, General. Only with my conscience. Really? Who won? Well, it was one of those rare occasions when violence really doesn't solve anything. I know the scenario well. Usually crops up when one is trying to decide whether to open the next bottle or not. Bar nodded at the door. After you. He produced a large umbrella from within his cloak, opened it and held it out.
General, allow me. Then he looked into the centre of the room. And what about your friend?
Oh. He looked back at the woman, who had turned herself around and was staring, horrified at them.
Yes, my captive audience. He shrugged. I've seen stranger mascots. Let's take her too.
Never question the High Command, Barr said.
He handed over the umbrella. You take this, I'll take her. He looked reassuringly at the woman, tipped his cap.
Only literally, ma'am.
The woman let out a piercing shriek. Rogtum Barr winced.
Does she do that a lot? He asked.
Yes, and watch her head when you pick her up. Near busted my nose.
When it's such an attractive shape already. See you in the amph, sir.
Right you are, he said, manoeuvring the umbrella through the doorway and walking down the concrete slope, whistling.
Bastard infidel!
The woman in the chair screamed as Rogtum Barr approached her in the chair from behind, cautiously.
You're in luck, he told her. I don't normally stop for hitches.
He picked up the chair with the woman in it and took them both down to the vehicle, where he dumped them in the back. She screamed the whole way.
Was she this noisy all the time?
Rogtum Barr asked, as he reversed the machine back out into the flood.
Mostly.
I'm surprised you could hear yourself think. He looked out into the pouring rain, smiling ruefully. In the ensuing peace, he was demoted and stripped of several medals. He left later that year, and the culture didn't seem in the least displeased with how he'd done.
Chapter 7. The city was built inside a canyon 2 kilometres deep and 10 across. The canyon wound through the desert for 800 kilometres, a jagged gash in the crust of the planet. The city took up only 30 of those kilometres. He stood on the rimrock, looking inwards, and was confronted by a staggered confusion of buildings and houses and streets and steps and storm drains and railway lines, all grey and misty in filmy layers under a foggy red setting sun. Like slow waters from a broken dam, nebulous rollers of cloud swung down the canyon. They foundered persistently among the juts and cracks of the architecture and seeped away like tired thoughts. In a very few places, the topmost buildings had overreached the rimrock and spilled onto the desert. But the rest of the city gave the impression that it lacked the energy or the momentum to proceed that far, and so had kept within the canyon, sheltered from the winds and kept temperate by the canyon's own natural microclimate. The city, speckled with dim lights, seemed strangely silent and motionless. He listened hard, and finally caught what sounded like the high howl of some animal from deep inside some misty suburb. Searching the skies, he could see the far specks of circling birds wheeling in the still and coldly heavy air, gliding in the deep distance over the cluttered terraces, stepped streets and zigzagging roads. They were the source of a far, hoarse crying. Further down, he saw some silent trains, thin lines of light slowly crossing between tunnels. Water showed as black lines in aqueducts and canals. Roads ran everywhere, and vehicles crawled along them, lights like sparks, as they scuttled like the tiny prey of the wheeling birds. It was a cold autumn evening, and the air was bitter. He'd taken off the combat suit and left it in the capsule, which had buried itself in a sandy hollow. Now he wore the baggy clothes that were popular here again. They had been in fashion when he'd worked here last time, and he felt oddly pleased that he'd been away long enough for the style to cycle round again. He was not superstitious, but the coincidence amused him. He squatted down and touched the rimrock. He lifted a handful of pebbles and topweeds, then let them sift through his fingers. He sighed and got to his feet, pulling on gloves, putting on a hat. The city was called Sulatol, and Soldrin Beishai was here. He dusted a little sand from his coat, an old raincoat from far away and of purely sentimental value, placed a pair of very dark glasses on his nose, picked up a modest case, and went down into the city.
Good afternoon, sir. How may I help you?
I'd like your top two floors, please.
The clerk looked confused, then leaned forward.
I'm sorry, sir.
The top two floors of the hotel. I'd like them.
He smiled. I haven't made a reservation. Sorry.
Ah,
the clerk said. He appeared a little worried as he looked at his reflection in the dark glasses.
There too?
Not a room. Not a suite. Not a floor. But two floors. And not any two floors. The top two floors. If you have any guests presently occupying any of the rooms in the top two floors, I suggest you ask them politely to accept a room on another floor. I'll pay their bills up till now.
I see,
the hotel clerk said. He seemed unsure whether to take all this seriously or not.
And how long was Sir thinking of staying?
Indefinitely. I'll pay for a month in advance. My lawyers will cable the funds by lunchtime tomorrow. He opened the case and took out a wad of paper money, placing it on the desk. I'll pay for one night in cash if you like.
I see,
the clerk said, eyes fixed on the money.
Well, if Sir would like to fill in this form...
Thank you. Also, I'll want an elevator for my personal use and access to the roof. I expect a passkey will be the best solution.
Ah, indeed, I see. Excuse me just a moment, sir.
The clerk went off to get the manager. He negotiated a bulk discount for the two floors, then agreed a fee for the use of the lift and the roof that brought the deal back to what it had been in the first place. He just liked haggling.
And sir's name?
I'm called Sabarind, he said. He chose a suite on the top floor, on a corner which looked out into the great depth of Canyon City. He unlocked all the cupboards and closets and doors, window shutters, balcony covers and drug cabinets, and left everything open. He tested the bath in the suite. The water ran hot. He took a couple of small chairs out of the bedroom and another set of four from the lounge and put them in another suite alongside. He turned all the lights on, looking at everything. He looked at patterns of coverings and curtains and hangings and carpets, at the murals and paintings on the walls, and at the design of the furniture. He rang for some food to be delivered, and when it came on a small trolley, he pushed the trolley in front of him from room to room, eating on the move while he wandered through the quiet spaces of the hotel, gazing all about, and occasionally looking at a tiny sensor which was supposed to tell him if there were any surveillance devices around. There weren't.